Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016. Jazza, how did you vote?
Oh my god, I love that it's such nostalgia flowing through my veins. I voted Remain because I'm the one who has lots of feelings. We meet every week to talk about politics, social issues and current events. For a very long time, we were the only podcast on the internet where someone who voted Leave and voted Remain could have a civil conversation with, with one another. And we're reviving it now because we're going to be talking about the Brexit negotiations.
Yes, indeed. Are there negotiations happening, or is it just news stories about negotiations happening or not happening, or you know, whatever the case may be? I suppose we will get into those fun details in the first segment of this podcast. Not wanting to spoil anything for listeners, I think you know most people will know where we roughly stand on things. It is coming to the point where in the new year the transition period will end, and we'll be into a bold new future of some sort, maybe.
A brave new world.
Yeah, I think that was the cliche I was reaching for, but you know, whatever. Jazza, what else are we going to be talking about in this episode?
We are also going to be discussing, well, we're big constitutional nerds here on the Right Dishonourable podcast, as you all should know, and we wanted to talk about the fact that the government are planning on repealing the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, obviously brought in 2011 in order to provide stability for an era of coalition government. Obviously, that stability's gone really, really well over the past few years, hasn't it, Jimmy? I have opinions about the executive taking back control. Oh, God, that's a triggering sentence. Taking back control from what was actually a huge amount of power from Parliament itself, rather than just the Prime Minister and the government. And so I guess we'll talk about the ramifications of us no longer having fixed-term parliaments that actually weren't really that fixed, because you could just call an election whenever you wanted, really. But anyway.
Yeah, I don't know actually if we're on the same page as regards how good or bad the act was and what our ideal is.
Jimmy, are you teasing a potential blow-up in our future conversation?
I don't want to over-tease. I think we probably both think that we don't really want the Prime Minister, in this case Boris Johnson, being able to call an election whenever he wants.
I don't want Boris Johnson to do anything at all, but I realise that I don't live in the reality where that is possible.
Okay, well, I think that's enough tease for our listeners. They can skip to the second segment if they're desperate to hear our thoughts on the Fixed Term Parliament Act and constitutional reform generally.
Oh my god, stop it, Jimmy. You're making me all hot and flustered.
Jazza, you suggested this third topic, so I think you should be the one to justify it.
So, it was recently announced that there was finally a confirmation of a bailout from the Premier League, which is the top league of football. Don't leave, listener. We're talking about football, but in a nerdy way. Don't leave. This isn't a sports podcast yet. They've agreed to contribute £250 million to bailouts of lower leagues of the English Football League. So that's the Championship downwards, and generally are the football leagues where, I mean, there's still quite a lot of money floating around, but have less lucrative TV deals, sponsorship deals, and all of that kind of stuff. This is going to be part of kind of like the sports relief fund that the government are putting together. They've scraped together £300 million to support all types of professional sport over the winter. But this is a really interesting case because they've gotten the Premier League to contribute a bailout of their rivals. And somebody suggested that it would be similar to getting Amazon to fund bailout of small businesses and small retailers, which actually I don't hate the idea of, to be completely honest, Jimmy. But I thought that this was quite an interesting thing that a Conservative government have decided to do in getting the private sector to to support kind of like the structure, the wider structure of their industry, which sounds like something out of a Corbyn playbook. But I guess we'll talk about the parallels with like the financial crisis and other industries and stuff like that.
I'm actually quite interested in this topic now. I thought it was going to be a washout, but it actually sounds like it's worth listening to.
Wow, thanks for saying yes to this, Jimmy. I appreciate it.
All right, without further ado, we are going to be playing some music and telling you about the Patreon page, which you can... I won't tell you the link. You'll hear it in a second anyway. But Jazza, should we get on with this here podcast?
Yeah, let's do it. Hello, dear listener. It is Jazza here. Just to pop in and remind you that we are indeed a listener-supported podcast. Without you guys, we wouldn't be able to do this. We already have a number of people supporting us on the crowdsourcing platform Patreon, who allow us to continue doing this without having to worry about paying for equipment, web hosting fees, and the like. So thank you very much to them. As a thank you to our patrons, we've actually been recording extra bonus parts to each of our episodes. Last week, we talked about chess in the rise since Queen's Gambit came out on Netflix. And this week, our bonus episode for patrons only is about Millwall fans booing footballers for taking the knee in respect for Black Lives Matter. It got a little more heated than we expected. Anyway, if you would like to support us on Patreon, then you will get those extra little tidbits into your ears as well. But for the rest of you, let's get on with the show.
Jazza, what celebrations do you have planned for the glorious 1st of January when we're finally free from the European yoke? I thought I delivered that quite well, actually.
European yoke.
That's Y-O-K-E, like rhymes with woke rather than, you know, the egg thing.
Yes, no, thank you. Not yolk.
Yolk, yeah.
I plan on getting drunk probably on my own or within my own bubble/household. What are you going to be doing? Because I'm sad about it, to be clear, I'm really sad about it. Jimmy, what are you going to be doing? Because clearly this is, everything's going to plan and exactly what you wanted to happen as a representative of the 52%.
I think I might have a little fry up to get over my New Year's hangover, presumably, from the previous night. I'm wondering if Sadiq Khan is going to repeat the trick he did from an earlier year where he organised some sort of European-style fireworks for the London New Year's fireworks. I wouldn't put it past him, but, you know, it's election day next year for him, so maybe not. I don't know. Interesting to see how he plays it. I don't know how our listeners feel about this. I'm pretty bored of Brexit right now. I'm sort of
Could have said no to this topic, Jimmy.
Well, no, I think it's you know, it is obviously, you know, it's probably the most important story this month. What actually, you know, whether we actually get a deal across the line or not, and I think particularly in terms of how Labour behave, whether they vote in favour of it, as seems to be, you know, the case if you sort of read the press at the moment, or whether they abstain, as the former Labour leader Neil Kinnock has advised them to do, so that Boris Johnson fully owns the deal. I guess we should start by talking about, you know, the deal that's in the works at the moment, or the thing that seems to be mostly on the table. What are your thoughts surrounding it?
Well, I feel like we've been in the final round of talks for the past 6 months. I too share your exhaustion. At the moment, we really are at crunch time, where there are a number of impasses that are making it very difficult for the UK and the European Union to move forward in any kind of negotiation. Fisheries keep on bloody coming up. If I never have to hear about the fishing industry, which is, by the way, 0.1% of national GDP, employs 25,000 people, I believe, and is smaller than the UK gaming industry, the less I hear about fishing in the future. Like, obviously, I've watched Doc Martin before. I am very nostalgic for, like, a little fisher village in North Cornwall. Like, you want to see those industries maintained. I think, like, really lovely, great. But also, it should not be... It is quite a ridiculous thing to plummet the rest of the UK into trade chaos in order to protect such a small part of your such a small part of your economy. Obviously, there are other things. Like, I think to a certain extent, I reckon there is going to be a deal, just because of the abject insanity of holding the rest of the economy ransom for the sake of 25,000 people who are employed across the UK in this industry. But I wouldn't put it past this government to fuck everything up.
I mean, the deal as it stands, at least outside of Northern Ireland, it's kind of a choice between a deal which would be a fairly hard Brexit and no deal, which would be the hardest form of Brexit. It's a relatively... I'm not saying that, you know, people shouldn't vote for the deal, and it won't have... I mean, the economic impact, I think, from the... it's the Office for Budgetary Responsibility that came out with these figures.
Are you quoting experts, Jimmy?
I'm not averse to experts. You know, I just don't think that, as we said with COVID scientists, expertise needs to be placed in its proper place and needs to be considered alongside matters of political judgments, which are not purely matters of expertise. Mm-hmm. But the OBR, I think, said a no-deal Brexit represents a 6% source of contraction in Britain's economy, whereas with the deal that's on the table, it's a 4% contraction. The economic consensus seems to be that, you know, Brexit is still going to cost us more than the COVID pandemic has, at least over the medium term. I suppose it's still an open question what happens beyond that. But it, you know, in a sense, you know, that seems to be, you know, Boris Johnson has already kind of decided that the British mainland will not be within the single market and the customs union. So, you know, I'm not saying it makes no difference, but it's clear that the soft Brexit crowd and the Remainers who wanted to push for a soft Brexit have already lost.
100%. Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, to my mind,
would you class your where would you class yourself on kind of like the tofu, banana, cucumber of Brexit?
Which one's which?
Tofu. It's actually it's quite inappropriately. It's actually apparently the scientific terms that they use to describe the hardness of a man's penis. So either tofu consistency, a banana consistency, or a cucumber consistency. Cucumber being the hardest, in case you are confused.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was going to say the banana, you know, depends on whether the skin's on or not, I would say, and the ripeness.
Yes, I think you're going for a medium to ripe banana.
Right, with the skin off, in this metaphor? This actually doesn't matter. we should move on. I think it's... I don't really have a settled position on this, to kind of be up front before I meander into the distance. You know, the reason that I voted Leave is this: I kind of don't really see myself as European in a political sense, and I don't really particularly want to be governed by it as a European. I also, you know, I have some objections practically to the kind of European integrationist project. You know, see Greece's treatment, you know, during all of the fiscal rows, for example. But you know, I think Britain should be governed as an independent country, but, you know, its exact relations with Europe are slightly difficult because, you know, as people have repeatedly pointed out, not least yourself, the EU is Britain's biggest export market, and that is likely to remain the case, you know, whether the deal is signed or not at this stage. I think in practice, like, you know, the hard Brexiters talk about sort of the bonfire of regulation they want to set off. I don't really
this see this ironically creates more regulation and more forms that you have to fill in and increases the amount of bureaucracy that exporters have to deal with, which,
yeah,
if I mean, you've got to find it funny, otherwise it's just depressing, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say, in a wider sense, I mean, you're kind of right with your point there, but in the wider sense, I just don't think that most people get the kind of, cucumber over, blowing up regulation that a lot of hard Brexiters and free trading Brexiteer buccaneers do. I was reading an article by Anand Menon and Jill Rutter in The Guardian. They're part of the UK in a Changing Europe think tank.
My lot or your lot?
I would say slightly more on your side of things. I suspect both of them voted Remain. But I'm not as familiar with Jill Rutter, but Anand Menon has been, very sort of even-handed with his analysis of Brexit in general. But he said that, broadly speaking, they said in the opinion piece that, broadly speaking, the consensus was for a softer Brexit on balance, and not the hard Brexit that we are effectively going to get when all this is said and done. But I think going forward, not to use that old kind of Remainer phrase, but this isn't a done deal in the sense that this is not the end of changes to Britain's relationship with Europe, which will, continue to change over time, not least under successive governments when they come in. So I don't, whatever is agreed, I don't really see it as a permanent state, or not agreed in the case of no deal. I don't think it's going to be a permanent state of affairs.
Jimmy, you aren't allowed to answer with anything other than a single word to this.
Okay.
Tofu, banana or cucumber?
I'm going to say banana. Is banana the middle one?
Yeah, banana is the middle one. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I think that, Britain should, I suppose I'm sort of, kind of a, like the Scottish National Party is to the UK question. I think it should be governed as an independent country, but I'm flexible as to the exact arrangements in terms of market access and that sort of thing, basically.
Mm-hmm. I won't get into the whole "we are an independent country anyway" thing, but
we aren't. We don't have, even during the transition period, we are not a fully independent country legally speaking. And any sort of body that has a parliament.
What do you define as independent country?
So for instance, Scotland has a huge amount of devolutionary powers, but it doesn't have, for instance, control of its foreign affairs. So Scotland, in relation to the UK, is less independent than the UK was in relation to the EU, during its membership years. I don't think this is a controversial observation, but the EU is an integrationist project that is seeking to move political powers in terms of legislative abilities and political decision making to a central body in Brussels, principally. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of the EU is to, people use phrases such as pool sovereignty, and in a sense, In the American context, you could say that sovereignty over certain things is pooled in Washington. And US states actually have significant lawmaking abilities, irrespective of what the federal government is doing. But the UK was not a fully independent country in the sense that, say, any African country is in relation to the African Union, which is a fairly thin sort of intergovernmental body, massively thin compared to the EU.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, we've just gone back into redoing the Brexit argument all over again. But
that's so unlike us.
The direction of travel, you've sort of seen it during the COVID pandemic, and it's not surprising.
Towards nation states rather than continental or international cooperation, right? Is that what you were going to say? Sorry.
No, I was going to say the opposite.
Kidding? Really?
In their vaccine procurement, you can see it in terms of the COVID bonds, which.
But in the initial responses, they were nationalised, and then even beyond that, regionalised.
Yeah, I would agree with
that. The European Union didn't decide lockdown rules in Benelux, for example.
It did not, but the nobody. I've not seen any commentator not view the sort of coronavirus bonds, as in the financial instruments that are put together to sort of fund the response to the COVID pandemic, as a massive step towards integration. I don't even think that's a controversial point among remaining Remain type people. I expect the EU will continue to integrate over time, and you do have cases such as. you know, the Polish government at the moment and the Hungarian government rebelling from, you know, rule from Brussels. That will continue to happen as well. There are sort of centrifugal and centripetal forces that are taking place. But I think overall, integration is where, if you just sort of read what Emmanuel Macron's saying in terms of, say, the European superpower versus, you know, counterbalancing China and America,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I think is where it's going. And, you know, I don't think I see why he's doing, you know, some people are pursuing that as a strategic move. I think that, you know, something that wasn't actually emphasized, I think, particularly on the Remain side, because they lost the argument, is that the EU is not a stationary force. I mean, you can talk about sort of what Vote Leave said in relation to, you know, 8 million Turks moving to the UK and that being dishonest, which it was. But the EU is not going to stand still. The Eurozone in particular, the Eurozone countries are going to continue to integrate. And it's hard to kind of see what Britain's long-term future was within that, given, you know, the obvious reluctance that we have towards further integration.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I kind of... I think that there is a desire towards that in the EU, or there was originally, maybe pre-Brexit, 10 years ago, there was this general trend towards further and further and stronger integration, especially post-financial crisis.
Mm.
But we've seen such a huge difference in how the EU has dealt with the coronavirus pandemic, this crisis, and like this, like a crisis like 12 years later, mm. Where it has been a lot more balkanized. And it has been a lot more led by independent states and then regions within those states as well, which I don't think necessarily... I don't think goes toward... I think the future integration plans that were kind of like teed up and are championed by people like Emmanuel Macron, who wants there to be a European army and wants there to be kind of like more of these centralized forces.
Hmm.
I think that the brakes are being tapped on those more integrationist projects at the moment, partially because of the states that you mentioned, like the Polands and the Hungaries and stuff like that.
But you're aware that vaccine procurement is being done by the
yeah, but that's members. that's a practical thing because it's cheaper, because it's easier for them to it's cheaper for them to buy that number of vaccines and then distribute it within them.
Right, but I mean, there are individual countries that would find it easier to do it alone, that, you know, don't necessarily need the, you know, would be able to react quicker. I mean, the UK has obviously acted quicker slightly because it is not obliged to act in concert with the 27 remaining members. You know, I see your point about it being practical and, you know, more cost effective, but I also think that is, you know, that is a sign that there are some, you know, integrationist responses to the pandemic. And I don't think long term the pandemic is going to change the general direction of travel. Well, you know,
I don't think the pandemic changed the direction of travel, but I think that it has highlighted some of those more general changes. I think that there is a more of a move towards the nation state, like independent state identities and stuff like that, even if it doesn't mean the dissolution of the European Union in the long run.
Right. But
that's just my opinion. You can't tell me I'm wrong.
I feel we've sort of deviated from the main topic at hand.
No, really?
I mean, I think as it stands, Boris Johnson is expected to be able to get the deal through, you know, assuming he manages to agree one, the House
of
Commons.
Well, he called Ursula von der Leyen yesterday, over the weekend. And that, from what I understand from international negotiations, whenever the top people, because most of the negotiations are happening with delegates, people who actually don't have any decision making, they're just there to kind of reinforce the positions that the government or that whoever they're representing is putting forward. But with a Boris Johnson and an Ursula von der Leyen conversation, I have heard that implies that there has been some kind of movement in their negotiation position.
Right.
And so, like, that it would be framed as a concession, but it will probably be dressed up as kind of like, obviously it's going to be dressed up as this great deal for everybody involved, regardless as to what the content actually is. But that, to me, that conversation over the phone implies that there has been some movement from their positions from the last couple of weeks.
But do we know what that movement is?
No, not yet. Okay. No, not yet. Probably something to do with fucking fish.
Probably. I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about, as I was kind of saying, Boris Johnson probably will be able to get his deal through without needing to rely on, say, votes from Labour MPs or SNP MPs even. There was this interesting article in The Guardian again about Neil Kinnock, who has apparently been advising the Labour Party to abstain on the vote so that Boris Johnson fully owns the deal and the ramifications for it. He's clearly worried that if Labour should in the future criticise some of these outcomes from the deal, the Tories will turn around and say, well, you voted for it, so you own it just as much as we do, which seems to be a reasonable criticism. I'm not entirely sure whether abstaining would fully insulate them from that sort of criticism, because presumably the Tories could say, well, you didn't vote against the deal, so you obviously didn't think it was that bad. And then, it sort of logically speaking, you can say, well, you know, Labour were caught between a rock and a hard place, you know, with the a deal they didn't like and a no deal outcome they also didn't like. But I think some of that will probably get lost in the mire a little bit. So I think I'm not sure Labour's general. I think abstaining might be their best option, but I'm not sure it's that good of an option. What do you think?
Were I Keir Starmer, and we can only dream. I would probably do an abstain in the same way that they did for the lockdown rules. I agree with the reported conversations that Neil Kinnock, or the things that Neil Kinnock has been saying, who obviously was the previous Labour leader who lost to John Major in 1992.
Correct.
The scenario that plays out in my head is that they are forever going to be labelled as, but you voted for this Brexit as well. And it really does. We expect Brexit to not be good for the country, at least in the short term, short enough term.
Not in economic terms, no.
Short enough term for at least the next election. And it makes sense tactically to get Boris Johnson and his team and the Conservative Party to own that. Like, obviously, they're going to try their best, regardless as to what the economic situation is, before the next election, whenever it is. Spoiler for the next topic. but it will be more beneficial to Labour if they manage to distance themselves from something that they expect to go badly. That makes total sense to me.
I think in...
And you do that by not voting at all, I think. I think voting against it has a similar problem. I think you can make the arguments. There's obviously going to be jibing from Conservatives, regardless of what Labour decide to do, if they don't, anything other than voting for the deal, is probably going to affect... is probably going to be criticised, but Labour, my answer to your question, sorry, is yes, they shouldn't abstain.
I read a piece by this commentator who's usually associated previously with the Lib Dems, although he's distanced himself more recently, called Nick Tyrone, who writes in The Spectator at the moment. And he said that he feels that Keir Starmer is gaining a reputation as being indecisive and a bit weak because of that. I think Boris Johnson in the House of Commons this week actually labelled Keir Starmer. There was some sort of line about Captain Hindsight has turned into general indecision. Or something along those lines.
He's good at those nicknames, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that, that's reasonable effort, I guess. Shame he didn't put that effort into just running the country well. Do you see Starmer as indecisive, and do you think that the general public see him as indecisive at the moment?
I don't think most of the general public know who Keir Starmer is. To be completely honest, he's not really been presented properly to the country yet, has he? And I think actually the longer that he remains vaguely ambiguous in this sense, probably the better for him. The closer, I think it's generally a lot better for an opposition leader to kind of be presented to the country for the first time as at an election or during an election campaign, really. But I personally don't see him as indecisive. I see him as actually really savvy as a political operator, actually.
Well, I quite like him, actually. I think for roughly the same reasons you do. But I think it's kind of interesting because obviously he came into office during the, once the pandemic had actually kicked off. And he has been taking a slightly interesting position in terms of he's criticizing the government regularly, and you know, we talked about the abstention on the COVID related votes as well, but I don't, he hasn't had an easy opportunity to establish himself, I don't think. And I'm wondering if, because I feel like the COVID pandemic, it's not going to come to an abrupt halt. I think it's more going to peter out, and I'm not sure there's ever going to be a neat opportunity for him to establish a brand for himself. And I wonder if he's already missed the boat on that one a little bit, whether, you know, his image will sort of be foisted upon him, which I guess, you know, tends to happen anyway. But I feel like in politics, people's initial impression of a given politician is very, very hard to shake. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even really sure it can ever be shaken. I think it's sort of first impressions, and then you're done. That is who you are forever, basically. At least in terms of, you know, the layman's kind of, you know, people who don't obsess about politics feel about you. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think, to sort of bring it back to Neil Kinnock's advice, I think it's sound, but I'm not sure if Keir Starmer is almost going to win sort of by default, just by sort of standing alongside while the Tory government fucks up in various ways, and then eventually saying, you know, are you guys bored of this now? Because you can vote for me, and I'm a, you know, I was a former Crown prosecutor,
I've got a chin, it's his most important asset.
Maybe we've probably flogged this dead horse long enough. So, you know, speaking of general elections, you alluded to it earlier, the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, which the I don't imagine you've actually read the bill, Jazza, because you're not as boring as I am.
Oh no, I haven't read the bill. I did read the government announcement though.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I think lays out most of what is, I mean, like the, at least the inspiration for why they're doing the bill, mainly because they hate being held accountable by the courts, and it was in their manifesto. Is that correct?
Yeah, so they are sort of talking it up as a kind of manifesto commitment.
Well, it was, to be fair.
It was, yeah.
Like they said that they wanted to do it and they got a majority, so they should probably do it. It is still, in my opinion, bad.
Yeah, so what they're trying to do is, so that the Fixed Term Parliaments Act was brought in, as Jazza alluded to in the introduction to the podcast, to make sure that the Tories didn't like welch on the agreement with the Lib Dems and sort of call an early election once the polls had turned in their favour and chuck the Lib Dems out of office. You know, the Parliament did hold firm for 5 years, although I do remember towards the end of the Condem government, the last year was sort of referred to as a bit of a zombie parliament and a zombie government because not very much was perceived to be.
Well, the Lib Dems were trying to separate themselves from the Conservatives, and the Conservatives were trying to make everything unpopular that they did the Lib Dems' fault, which worked, obviously.
Yeah, it did. So in that narrow sense, it did work. As you also said, the Act has not really fixed the term of a parliament. Parliaments were limited to 5 years anyway. But I mean, in practice, because of the system we have, it's pretty much impossible without some massive, massive constitutional reform to, or just a huge change in norms to prevent any sort of government which has a majority from just, you know, writing a bit of legislation saying we'd like to call an early election, which is what was done.
Twice.
What was done twice? Well, actually, the first time did actually follow the procedures of the Fixed Term Parliament Act in that a two-thirds majority in the House of Commons signed off on the election.
Mm-hmm.
The second time round, a bit of legislation was actually written in the House of Commons. This might seem like kind of a narrow point, but actually one of the consequences of that was that the House of Commons effectively had to sign off on an election date rather than the Prime Minister just being able to decide when that election was unilaterally, which I think is quite an important thing. So the Fixed Term Parliaments Act actually you can criticize it in many ways. I don't think it's responsible for the gridlock during 2019. I think what was responsible for that was that the House of Commons was divided.
It was the hung parliament.
Yeah, it was a hung parliament. The hung parliament was able to stop Boris Johnson from having a general election for a while, while also rejecting his deal.
They actually cite the quote unquote chaos. I don't think I need to quote unquote. Actually, it was chaos last year. Like Chloe Smith, who's the Constitution and Devolution Minister, said that the Fixed Term Parliament Act caused constitutional chaos last year, which, when combined with total gridlock in Parliament, meant the previous government couldn't deliver what it was asked to do. Ultimately, at critical moments for our country, we trust the public to decide. Lol. Which this is kind of the opposite of that. So we are going back to the system that lets elections happen when they are needed.
Well, you're right in that last, well, right in that last bit in a sense, but I think what Chloe Smith said is disingenuous in a number of ways. Firstly,
mm-hmm. Go on, serve it to us, spill that tea.
So firstly, the chaos, given it was chaotic and there was gridlock, but that gridlock did represent genuine division in the House of Commons as to what the next step should be. For a long time, actually, I remember it looked as though calling an election wouldn't necessarily solve anything. In reality, once the election was called, Boris Johnson was able to, get a majority for the next parliament.
Was able to get Brexit done.
Well, almost. Almost. Don't cash that check until we know that it's good. I don't think that stopping a prime minister from doing what he wants to do because he can't really command a majority of the House of Commons is necessarily that bad, to be honest.
Yeah, because he doesn't have a majority in the House of Commons. He does it like the people have decided, and the people have decided that you shouldn't be a powerful prime minister. Like I really dislike the returning of powers that were given to parliament, who represent the people.
Yeah,
and
well,
giving it back to the executive.
I mean,
Stephen Bush from the New Statesman claimed that this is the first time in our country's history that returning of powers to the executive has ever happened.
I mean, I don't think that is. I suppose it depends what you mean by that, but in a strict sense, I doubt very much that that's true.
Seeing as you're not on Twitter, I'll have to let Stephen Bush know then.
I mean, we're an old country, so saying that this is unprecedented is risky at the best of times. But I think he's possibly right that a royal prerogative power has never been returned, has never been restored in modern in sort of post World War II British history. That probably is true. And that is what a lot of commentators around this have said. Something else that I just want to sort of pick at this point about chaos a little bit longer is that part of the reason for that chaos is not only was Boris Johnson able to command a majority in the House of Commons on his deal, but actually part of the reason they didn't want him just to call an election was that they didn't trust him not to call an election after the relevant Brexit deadline at the time. Get Brexit in by the back door by bypassing Parliament. And you can kind of criticise the... I know Joe Swinson, the Lib Dems, were kind of instrumental in bringing about an election at the end, and you can criticise them for what happened if you're a Remainer, but, she did force Boris Johnson to obtain a parliamentary majority and call a general election before the relevant deadline. That is some sort of achievement in a way, mm-hmm. and that was enabled by the Fixed Term Parliaments Act.
What do you think are the consequences of us going back to? So for anybody who doesn't know who is listening, because actually quite a lot of our listeners probably don't remember when there wasn't the Fixed Term Parliament Act and weren't kind of like politically engaged. Then it is now the government gets to choose when the election is. That can, means that they decide whenever their popularity is higher, and actually they get a little bit of a jump on the opposition, supposedly, so the opposition has to be more than that.
To tell that to Theresa May, I guess.
Yeah, sure, that's a fair point.
So you mean under the royal prerogative powers that would be brought about by repealing the Fixed Term Parliaments Act?
Yes, exactly. The Prime Minister has to go to the Queen and go, "Mom, or ma'am, or mom? Who knows? I don't watch The Crown. Can we dissolve Parliament and can I get a new one, please?" And then that triggers the election process. This is when it comes to triggering the elections, there's still the 5-year term limit. So there the Parliament has to be dissolved at the end of 5 years anyway. Mm-hmm. And so that means, and we have a couple of examples of this in recent history. I'm thinking of Gordon Brown's government and of John Major's government as well in the 90s, where you're so unpopular and it's so obvious that if you went to an election, you would lose, that you just hang on for power for as long as you possibly can.
I think, it should be said in those instances that, at any point in time, irrespective of what the Prime Minister does, the House of Commons can, this was pre-Fixed Term Parliaments Act, actually, the Act obscured the situation somewhat, but under the kind of royal prerogative system, if you like, the House of Commons could at any point say, we don't have confidence in the Prime Minister, and that would trigger a general election. Mm-hmm. The House of Commons still had some leeway and some options. Essentially it meant the House of Commons could call a general election and the Prime Minister could also call a general election separately using different avenues. I'm basically with you that I think I would prefer the House of Commons to still have final sign-off on whether an election takes place. In practice, this will not make a huge amount of difference it shouldn't, because most Prime Ministers will probably have a majority behind them in the House of Commons anyway. It's already been proved that Boris Johnson could call another general election right now without repealing the Fixed Term Parliaments Act by just passing the legislation with a majority, which he has.
Mm. I think we're also missing something else by repealing the Fixed Term Parliament Act that I don't think many people have really talked about, and that is some semblance of stability, of there being people knowing when there is going to be an election, that allows for there to be 5-year plans in government, for example, or it allows for businesses to plan around kind of like those cycles. It allows for smaller parties and parties to be able to plan the way that they approach their policy writing, their policy making, or their messaging around those 5-year cycles, rather than having all of that power of when all of these moments happen being in centralized into the government. We haven't really had, we've only had one actual fixed term of parliament.
Since the act was signed anyway.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's a real shame that we are going to lose the opportunity of being able to grow that as a part of our politics and our economics and things like that.
I think you're slightly... I'm not as persuaded by the five-year thing. I think I used to think it was quite attractive, but I'm not sure, partly because I think it can create those sort of zombie administrations which should really be hoofed out of office, but won't be because there's an extra year to go or whatever. I think that is a legitimate problem.
But if that stuff goes really badly, then you can get a two-thirds majority to kick him out.
I mean, in practice, you're never going to get that. So without the government whipping for it, I think the two-thirds majority thing is kind of a non-starter, really. And also, I think it is necessary and it is good to be able to dissolve a parliament early if the House of Commons is against what the government is trying to do, like a significant policy thing such as, Brexit. I think it is right that governments collapse early if they're unable to run the country, basically, push forward a major policy, a significant policy. I actually think that is quite important. The other thing is that even though we haven't had, we've had five-year limits for quite, I think, since the early 1900s or something, it has generally been the culture of government in the UK to have, 4 years in government, and then there's an election somewhere between the fourth year and the fifth year. And I think that's kind of okay. I think that's acceptable. I don't think it needs to be, you know, stapled down to 5 years each time. I think the benefits of that, you know, are kind of outweighed by the costs, really, that I've just outlined. I will say, on an entirely separate point, this whole thing about restoring the royal prerogative legally looks to me a little bit dicey. And I only say that because I actually read through the House of Commons report into the
Oh no, what did it say? The only thing, whenever I hear royal prerogative, I just go to, I'm so sorry about lowering the tone here, but I go to the Putney Spears song and I just sing in my head, it's a prerogative, I will do what I want to do. But go on, what do you see as the, what do you see as the problem?
Well, it's actually not even what I see. So various witnesses to this committee, in which goes under it's the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee, and they did a report into the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, and they all said, basically, they advised against trying to restore the royal prerogative because there is some measure of legal uncertainty as to whether a royal prerogative can be restored once it's been abolished by statute. The way that the government is trying to get around this is it said in the statute that we're restoring the royal prerogative. So, you know, they're restoring a royal prerogative by statute. Just in terms of context for this, because it is a bit weird. Royal prerogatives were essentially powers that were understood to reside with the crown, i.e., you know, the monarch or the queen in this case, because they hadn't been taken control of by Parliament. So if Parliament has taken control of it, it's not actually legally clear whether they can hand it back in a straightforward way. But the government is aware of this, and so it has also inserted in the bill some clauses basically saying that the courts cannot review the use of this royal prerogative power to call elections. I'm not entirely sure that will work as a persuasive argument before the Supreme Court. I mean, it's possible, you know, there might be a judicial review of this power at some stage. You know, Gina Miller, I'm sure, is taking a look at this very interestedly. And if not her, somebody else will be.
Oh, I hope she is. I can't. A world without Gina Miller on the front pages is a worse world, in my humble opinion.
And it's possible the Supreme Court, if this gets to the Supreme Court, it's possible the court will say, well, you know, Parliament has legislated that we shouldn't touch this, so we won't touch this. But it's possible, you know, I wonder if that is the case, because, you know, in some ways the effect of this act is actually to, you know, disenfranchise Parliament in a way. At least as regards general elections are called. And it's almost like a sort of circular situation where, like, can the Supreme Court sign off on Parliament disempowering itself when, you know, the role of the Supreme Court in parliamentary affairs or constitutional affairs is to say Parliament is sovereign. So do you see what I'm saying? It's sort of like would be signing off legislation that makes Parliament a bit less sovereign. So,
but then if it's the desire of Parliament, Jesus Christ, what a mess.
Well, yeah, I, you know, that's like a logical point, I guess, rather than a legal one. But it does seem like, you know, both the...
Yeah, it's stupid.
both the Commons Committee and the Lords Committee, Constitutional Committee, that looked at the same thing, said, you know, when you write this legislation, please don't try and restore the royal prerogative as it was, because it will be open to legal challenge. So that seems bad to me.
Oh my God, I can't. With Gina Miller, I can hear the horn of Gina Miller being announced coming over the hill. It's like Isengard.
Yes, very much so. Speaking of horns and vuvuzelas, do you want to discuss football?
Oh, Jesus, not Jimmy. I think we need to have a conversation. Not everything needs to have a segue.
Everything needs to have a terrible segue.
Jesus, is that our brand now that Brexit isn't going to be our thing anymore?
Established precedent in this podcast is to have bad segues.
Right, so we're going to talk about football now. Don't worry, it's really wonky, nerdy stuff about football. We don't care about the fact that Tottenham Hotspur are at the top of the Premier League at the moment.
I knew that, obviously.
I'm very happy about that. It doesn't happen. Yeah. That shit doesn't happen very often, Jimmy, I can tell you. But the basically the Premier League have agreed to a £250 million bailout for the lower football leagues of England specifically. So the Premier League is kind of its own entity, and all of the clubs all act as shareholders in the Premier League. They end up negotiating television deals, which are incredibly lucrative. So like every 3 years, they negotiate a new deal for the rights to their matches, which then obviously end up making a lot of money for the broadcasters, both domestically and internationally, because the Premier League is the most popular league in the world. Unfortunately, it's not the same for the Championship or the lower leagues, because the football isn't as good, one would argue.
Why that, Jazz?
Whoa! but because of a lack of lucrativeness, football is quite interesting in that it kind of mirrors the inequalities that we have in wider society and across all types of industries, in that
topic is really blowing up.
I know, right? So much of the power is they're also it's a really successfully unionized workforce as well. It's one of the reasons that players get paid so much now. Anyway, it's fascinating. But the Premier League, so much of the power and the money is focused there. And then there is a certain amount of trickle down, but nowhere near as much as somebody like Ronald Reagan would want you to say that there were. I'm not sure about how the 250 million gets split out. Originally, the Premier League were we don't want to contribute anything to any kind of support of the lower leagues, despite the fact that the Premier League definitely relies on the pyramid structure of the lower leagues for future talent, for the incubation of, for example, managers and trainers and stuff like that. It's a really important part of their recruitment funnel are the lower leagues, and so it would be really, really bad for the Premier League as well if all of the lower English football leagues also dissolved or had financial problems, maybe had to fold because of COVID. And the English football leagues have only recently been able to have any fans back, and for a lot of these, especially further down the leagues you go, the more reliant they are on fan tickets rather than sponsorships and broadcast deals and all of those kinds of things. I wanted to talk about this because the government twisted the Premier League's arm and said, no, we need you to contribute to the football leagues. And the Premier League initially were but these are our rivals. these are people that we are literally competing against in football, and people that we are competing for eyeballs against, and fans and money against.
So I want to dispute this rivals thing. Because I see your point, but the Premier League doesn't really compete with the Championship, does it? The international audience, the Premier League is the first division, the Championship is the second division. So, that's reflected in terms of sporting skill and all the rest of it. I guess there are people that say that the Premier League has lost touch with, football's roots and will, stubbornly just watch lower league football. But, most people who support a lower league team will also have a Premiership team, right?
Yeah.
That tells you what you need to know, really.
Yeah. I enjoy going to watch Walthamstow play because it is it's basically a Sunday league team. But I am I support Tottenham Hotspur. But I think that the obviously they're all part of the same ecosystem. And I do understand that I think that the Premier League are right to call out how weird it is that they are being asked to contribute to this.
No offense to football teams are always blowing their own fucking trumpet about how much they value community and all the rest of it. Fucking stump up then. Do you know what I mean?
But I think that the analogy and comparing it to getting somebody like Amazon to pay for the funds going to furloughing employees on high street retailers and stuff like that, I think that that's an interesting parallel to draw between them.
But, you know, Amazon has no real relationship, like mutually beneficial relationship with the high street in the way that, as you outlined at the start of the segment,
maybe not the
Premier League
not the
has
high
with
street,
the other.
But like smaller retailers who do actually plug into the Amazon's ecosystem, right? As perhaps maybe they use Amazon Web Services, or maybe they use Amazon to be able to deliver their and host their products. Like that's valid, right?
That is, I mean, that is true, but I mean, we're not asking Amazon to bail out Debenhams, you know. That's
Why not?
that's not what's happening here, I don't think. Like, you know, if you go and buy something from Debenhams, which is in the process of shutting down in the UK, you're not going to then go buy that same product from Amazon. So they're direct competitors in a very straightforward way. Mm-hmm. But as I said, I don't think the Premier League really competes with the Championship. And I think that, you know, given those community values, you know, and, you know, they're always talking about how they value grassroots football. Grassroots football is the lower leagues. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not arguably the Championship, but it's definitely the stuff below that. And it, as you said, it's all part of one ecosystem. So I think it's totally fair, you know, to expect them.
I just found it very like, I think that this is a good thing. I do think that £250 million is a laughably small amount of money.
Well, I was actually going to say, because I don't know that you've outlined this specifically, is that it's a £50 million bailout,
yes,
for English,
and then the rest
clubs.
Are loans. Yeah.
The rest are loans. Yeah. So, you know, in many ways, it's actually smaller than the headline.
Yeah, like
as
an example, over the transfer window earlier this year, Chelsea spent over £200 million on buying new players. This is a tiny, almost insignificant amount of money. And if there are any League One or Two teams that are having problems and need to dip into this fund, they won't be able to cover their overheads for very long because players are bloody expensive. That 50 million or 250 million, however you want to slice it, is not going to last very long. So there's this big song and dance being made about it, and it's actually not that much money at all. They're barely going to... The Premier League is barely going to notice that amount of money. When it... the other thing that I found really interesting was that we had conservative ministers saying that they wouldn't be able to justify the bailing out of companies, essentially. They have a wider £300 million fund for competitive sport over the winter.
That's separate to
they need it, including
these measures,
them.
Right?
It is. Some of it will probably... Some of it is intended for women's football specifically, and is intended for much for lower league football. So for teams much lower down in the leagues. But they deliberately siloed off kind of like the top to middle level of the football leagues, because they couldn't justify giving... They said they couldn't justify giving bailout money to millionaires that have ridiculous salaries, and all of the owners of the clubs get huge amounts of bonuses and all of those kinds of things.
Okay.
And I agree with that, but that does not sound like the kind of thing that a conservative politician would usually talk about. And I think that, and I wanted to kind of draw the comparison, suggest the comparison of the way that, I mean, people were talking about that during the financial crisis in 2008, right? That you couldn't justify giving this amount of bailout money to banks that had, that were paying and giving huge bonuses to their CEOs and employees and all of those kinds of things.
Why do you think that doesn't work? Sorry, the bailouts weren't in the case of the banks. And I mean, also, I guess, in a way, in the case of these football clubs, it's not really for the multimillionaire employees. It's in the case of the banks, it was to keep the financial system going, because the collapse of it would, you know, not just be a disaster for those particular banks and the people who work in them, would be a disaster much more broadly. Now, there is obviously a whole conversation about those banks being poorly regulated in the first instance to get themselves into that mess, but let's not go there right now. I mean, I think it, you probably draw a good comparison in, I think you do draw a good comparison in a way that, you know, nobody really gives a shit about whether, I'm struggling to name a current football player now, but, you know, whoever's, you know, whether, you know, the star player from Tottenham is earning multi, you know, millions of pounds. Mm-hmm. You know, it's obviously good for him that he can, you know, keep bread on the table. But
yeah, I don't think Harry Kane is struggling to feed his family. Let's just say that.
Right. Yeah. But the, you know, there's a huge amount of value of like social value in football clubs, and I think actually at the heart of I'd say this as someone who doesn't really care a lot about football, but there's a huge tension in football generally that these are multi-million pound businesses that, you know, were largely set up often in the 1800s and early 1900s as like community associations, mm-hmm. Really for, you know, local workmen to play football. And they still sort of, they sort of sit on that, on the gap between those two things of it being a business that wants to rake in as much money as possible, and also
they're media companies essentially is what they are more than anything. They sell the rights, they make money off of the rights, they produce their own content, they have their own subscription services, etc. etc.
You can take the boy off YouTube, but you can't take the YouTube out of the boy.
Of course, never.
But you are right. Effectively, that is what has made the Premier League so lucrative, is those big broadcasting details. And, you know, they are content producers at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that, I mean, football in particular, there's a couple of other sports you could say this is true of to a lesser extent. I'm thinking of like rugby and cricket, really. But football has a huge importance in the British psyche, I think. It is the national game. So there's kind of a wider political capital to be gained by helping out football that you wouldn't necessarily get from, you know, helping out golf, let's say.
I think you just found the worst example.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, golf is literally
Tory donors, maybe.
I think you can make the argument that football has a net good for society.
Right.
I don't think that you can make that argument about golf.
Oh, that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. I'm saying you don't really want to, like, golf does not have.
No, I was supporting you in your use of that as the.
The best. Yeah,
Sorry, I should have said you found the best example, but they are the worst example of that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think we've, from starting off at the start of this podcast with Brexit, we have reached a rare point of agreement on this podcast. So, you know. Maybe it's time to wrap things up.
Excellent. Jimmy, where can they find you? Not on the internet. You've got to email him. Although he does keep on tweeting, if you have a look, dear listener. You can find him at JDE Nichols if you really want.
I feel like Jazz's self-esteem would, inflate to unchecked levels if I didn't keep tweeting at him. So that's a sort of community good.
Well, somebody's like football, got to keep really. Me in check, haven't they? And then if you want to tweet at me as well, I'm at JazzaJohn on all social platforms. One day I will post something again.
What's happening with your YouTube channel?
Don't shut up.
Okay. That's a sore point. Okay, let's stick with the golfing thing.
Yeah.
All right, let's wrap it up there.